Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Reader's Prize Ann Patchett for her inspired fiction with novels such as State of Wonder and Bel Canto. But since the beginning of her career, she has written nonfiction pieces. In her new book, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, Patchett has selected some of her finest pieces, carefully curating a collection that reads almost like a memoir and welcomes us into her world from childhood to today. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Ann Patchett to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
When you think about your writing career, and of course, as I mentioned in the introduction, most people certainly know you for your fiction work. Is the nonfiction always been kind of A, the beginning, and B, the go-to where you can explore different ideas and thoughts?
Well, for a long time, nonfiction was how I made a living. I had taught for a while. It did not seem time efficient to try and teach and then go home at night and write a novel. And so I figured out I was really good at doing nonfiction and I could do it fast and I could make money. So that's where it started, which is actually a good place to have started because I have always associated it with something that was easy, with something that came naturally, and was something that's just sort of a pure pleasure. And over the years, I wound up doing more interesting pieces and more serious pieces, but I really got my start at 17 Magazine and Bridal Guide, and I wrote a ton of junk.
Writing a ton of junk, it makes you a better writer, though, doesn't it?
Well, it sure makes me a better workhorse. And I think it probably does make me a better writer because I paid a lot of attention to whatever the magazine wanted. I learned how to fit my voice to the readership, and I learned how to get rid of anything that was superfluous. I mean, it's not so much about working on a deadline for me, because I've got no problems with deadlines. I'm not a procrastinator. But it's that if somebody says, I want 800 words, I want 1,200 words, I want 2,000 words, it was all about writing to the shape of the piece. And in fiction, you can just go on and on forever, but actually that can make for really sloppy fiction. So the nonfiction kind of made me more disciplined.
As you mentioned, you did much of the nonfiction to get paid and to get a paycheck. Was writing fiction always the goal, to have that luxury?
Oh, sure. And I kind of grew up believing that writing fiction wasn't anything I was ever going to get paid for. I mean, I had a very La Boheme view of life as an artist, and I thought that it meant starving to death. And so I never was trying to write commercial fiction. I really just wrote the kind of fiction I wanted to read, but I did very commercial nonfiction. It was a nice balance.
And at what point do you then find that you have an audience, that people are following you?
Well, for fiction, it's really easy to tell because you look at your numbers. They have a spreadsheet and they'll tell you exactly how many copies of the book you've sold. So, you know, I could pretty much walk you through how many copies each of the books have sold. And my first three novels, I was what we call a mid-list author, a modest mid-list author, which was, you know, my book sold in the 10,000 range in hardback and a little better, maybe 20,000 in paperback. And then with Bel Canto, that was my, quote, breakout book. And then I started selling a lot more books. So it wasn't until Bel Canto that I could have made my living writing fiction. Before that, while I wrote my first three books, that was love. That was what I really wanted to be doing, but I was doing nonfiction to support it. And then once I didn't have to write nonfiction anymore, I suddenly realized that I loved it. And then I started really having fun with it because I was just taking the assignments that I wanted.
Can you go crazy thinking about why or what it is about that book, about Bel Canto, that struck a chord?
No, I know exactly what it is about Bel Canto that struck a chord. It was published in June of 2001, and it's, you know, very nominally a book about terrorism and people being taken hostage. And when September 11th happened, that was really when the book became popular. And I think that not unlike The Kite Runner, which was a book that was set in Afghanistan after September 11th, that book came out at about the same time, people were suddenly very interested in reading about Afghanistan. We were going to war in Afghanistan. And it became very popular. Certainly, there was nothing in Bel Canto that would tell anybody anything about what had happened to our country on September 11th. But people started reading it in book groups because they felt they wanted to talk about these issues.
In talking about those issues, did it change you in the sense of things that you wanted to talk about and open up avenues to realize that you had an audience to discuss very important topics?
Not really. I mean, I don't think that that experience changed me as a writer. There were things that I really wanted to talk about in my first three books that I did when nobody particularly was reading them. And after... I still don't think people read my books. I have a funny mental block about that. I sort of secretly believe that people are buying them in large numbers and building extra bathrooms on the side of their house out of copies of Bel Canto or State of Wonder. Whenever I meet somebody who says, "Oh, I've read all your books," I think, "Really? Like, are we related?" And that's probably, I think, very healthy. That I don't sit down to write with an image of people reading my books. I'm still just writing about the things that are interesting to me, and that always changes book to book.
And another way of saying that, you would write that book whether there was an audience or not. So there
sure.
isn't, you can't be concerned if there are 100,000 people who are buying that book, great. If there are 4 people getting that book, it would be the same for you because it's the work that you're doing.
Absolutely. And I don't sell my books before I'm finished with them, which is pretty unusual for somebody kind of at my career level. And I don't show them to anybody until I'm absolutely finished with them. So it really is the book I want to read for myself. It's what's interesting to me. And I can remember before I wrote Bel Canto, when I was putting it together, and I had lunch with Cork Smith, who had been my editor for Magician's Assistant, which was my third book. And he said, "So, you know, what are you going to do next?" And I said, "I want to write this book. It's set in Peru, and it's about a hostage crisis and opera." And I sort of talk him through the plot that's in my head. And he looks at me and he leans over and he pats my hand and he said, "Let's keep this one under our hats, kitten." And I think that all of my books sound horrible in advance. You know, who wants to read a book set in South America about terrorism and opera? That's a really bad idea for a book. So, you know, you don't think, wow, this is a great idea for a book and it's really going to sell. That's just not the way I work.
At what point did you think that it would be appropriate that you wanted to put together a collection of the nonfiction pieces?
I have a friend named Nikki Castle, who is a young woman who used to babysit my sister's kids when she was in college. And my family has kind of taken her in. We've always loved Nikki. She moved to New York and worked for my agent for several years, got tired of New York, and she called me and she said she wanted to move to Nashville. And she moved to Nashville and she didn't have a job. And so I said, you can come and work for me. I've never had an assistant. You can work for me until you find a job. And I think that she worked for me for about 2 months, and there was really nothing to do. She reorganized my files. She reorganized my closet. And then she went into this big Tupperware box that I had of tear sheets from all of the magazine work I had done in the last 25 years. And she said, "I'm going to put together a book of essays." And I said, I don't want to write a book of essays. I don't want to do that. And she said, "Well, you know, I'm out of things to do, and this is what I'm going to do." So she went through, she read all of the articles, and there were really literally hundreds of articles. And she put together a book. She made me read it, which I put that off for months. I didn't want to read it. And I could see the way she had shaped it. It could be a good book, but I thought a lot of what she had chosen wasn't good. And so I got rid of those pieces. But then I started to think, well, what's missing? What piece do I want to write to fill this narrative arc? And I kept writing new pieces and taking pieces out and writing new pieces and taking pieces out. And Nikki kept looking at it. But really, when I think back on this book, if it hadn't been for her quitting her job in New York and moving to Nashville, there's really no way I would have ever gone into that Tupperware box myself and put this book together. And that said, I love the book. I'm really happy with it. I just needed somebody to force me to do it.
And I see in some of the early word of the book that it is labeled as memoir. There are certainly pieces in here that would qualify as that, but it's certainly not a standard memoir.
I think it's a book that is about the things in my life that I feel profoundly committed to. When I read a book of essays that somebody else has written, the problem so often is there will be two or three or four fantastic essays, and then the rest of the book feels like filler, you know, letters to the editor and shopping lists and whatever they can put in there to pad it out to 180 pages to make it a book length. And so I was really interested in the idea of what if I had a book of essays that had a theme, that had a kind of narrative arc so that it would read like a novel. And my point was, what are the things that I care passionately about? And they were books and book selling. I own a bookstore in Nashville. Writing and making art, marriage, dogs, family, friends. Some things that I did, for example, trying out for the Los Angeles Police Department, that were things that I just really, really cared passionately about at the time, and trying to put those things in order to kind of make a whole.
And like the novels, is it something that you are assigned to write, or you decide you write it and then find a home for it?
It's kind of neither. I mean, in the early days, it was assignments. It was definitely assignments. But now it's that magazines or different places will call me and say, we want you to do something. What are you interested in doing? I actually never have the experience of I just sit down and write an essay and then I take it and try to place it. But for example, the title story, This is a Story of a Happy Marriage, which is a really, really long piece. Audible, which is the audiobook company, called me and they said they wanted to do their first Audible original. So they wanted either a piece of nonfiction or fiction that would be quite long. I think it was 40 or 50 pages. And it would just be produced for Audible. And I said, okay, I can do that. And they said, what do you want to write about? And I decided, after thinking about a lot of different things, that I wanted to write about marriage. So that's kind of how these days I come mostly to assignments.
I like this story because, well, you write about Saratoga in that story and Yaddo.
Yeah, I do. I do. I was at Yaddo. I was 25 years old, and that's kind of where my first marriage fell apart and where my life got a much better start and went on from there. But Saratoga Springs does figure into that piece a lot.
Is it almost easier to have it channeled for you, or do you feel the compulsion sometimes to write about something that you want to explore or play with?
Yeah, you know, I certainly that's the way I do with fiction. That's the way I feel about fiction. I, you know, I have an idea. There's something I'm really interested in working out, solving, thinking deeply about. But in nonfiction, I find, for whatever reason, that I need to know where the piece is going. And I think that it's because I worked so hard when I was starting out doing nonfiction, writing for particular venues, that in my mind, I really need somebody to say, you know, we need this 2 weeks from Thursday. It needs to be 3,000 words. It needs to be about X. Those parameters I've kind of come to rely on in nonfiction. And the fact is, nonfiction assignments, straight up assignments where somebody just called and said, do you want to do this, have taken me to some incredibly interesting places. There's a piece in the book called My Road to Hell Was Paved. And that was an assignment from Outside Magazine in which they gave me a Winnebago and asked me to drive through the Badlands and out to Yellowstone and kind of infiltrate Winnebago culture and expose it for the horrible underbelly that it really was of the hiking society. And it turns out I had a fantastic time. I loved it. I loved my Winnebago. Outside Magazine didn't like the piece. They weren't happy because they wanted me to write about how horrible Winnebagos were. So I wound up writing about how horrible they were. But then when I was putting this book together, I thought, you know, that was a fantastic trip. And I didn't write about anything that really happened or anything that was fantastic about it because I wasn't supposed to be loving Winnebagos. So I went back, threw the piece out, and then rewrote it the way I wished I had written it for the magazine. So also this book was full of second chances for me.
Given where you are, as you say, in your career, do you balk at that idea of being edited and changing of how you feel and how your thoughts on a subject are portrayed?
No, I've never balked at being edited unless, and this doesn't happen very often, and it always floors me when it does. Every now and then I'll turn a piece in and somebody will say, oh, that's fine. This doesn't really happen now, but it used to happen all the time. And then the magazine comes out and I think, man, I didn't write this. You know, they just rewrote it and kept my name on it. So there's a difference between editing and just rewriting somebody. Right. And if somebody says, you know, we want you to work on this or we want you to change this and it's a dialogue, I'm not a sensitive person and I'm really open to being edited as long as I'm involved in the process.
You mentioned a few moments ago, and it's certainly well known in the book world, that you are co-owner of Parnassus Books in Nashville, Tennessee. You write about it a few times in the book, including an essay entitled The Bookstore Strikes Back. What led you to book selling?
Well, you know, like so many other cities in America, I just woke up one morning and my bookstores were gone. They had closed. They were big 30,000 square feet bookstores. One of them was a Borders, and of course the entire Borders chain went under. The other one was a bookstore called Davis Kidd, which when I was coming along in Nashville had been one of our much loved local independents, but it had been bought out by a chain in Ohio and they moved it into the mall and it was now 30,000 square feet and it wasn't independent anymore. And both of those bookstores closed within 6 months of each other. So suddenly Nashville didn't have a bookstore. I didn't want to open a bookstore. It never really occurred to me for a long time that this was my job. But everybody was talking about it. Nobody was getting anything done. I met Karen Hayes. We were introduced by a mutual friend as the two people who really wanted to make sure there was going to be a bookstore in town. And so we threw in together and opened a bookstore. And it just wouldn't ever have been possible for me unless I was working with Karen, because I don't work in the bookstore. That's not my job. I don't draw a paycheck. And she really is the person who's there all the time, ordering the books, hiring the staff, you know, making sure the trains run on time. And I'm the person who paid for the bookstore. And I do a lot of publicity. And I know every writer out there. So it's been very easy for me to make sure that my friends come down and give readings. And that's a great way to keep bookstores alive.
Anything about the process that has surprised you?
A lot of things have surprised me. Mainly, I've just been surprised by how much I love it and what a joy it's been. I went into it sort of feeling like it was my duty. Like, ugh, I have to do this for Nashville. I love Nashville. It needs a bookstore. I guess it's going to be me. I didn't really think about how much fun it would be. And the thing that I love, well, probably the thing that I love most is I love the staff. I love the people who work there. You know, it's like hiring a group of people who are smart and funny and fantastic readers and getting to go over there every day and talk to them. That's the greatest joy in the world. But also the joy of recommending books. I think that anybody who really loves to read takes such pleasure in being able to say to people, you've got to read this book. Karen Joy Fowler's We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves. I love that book. The Good Lord Bird, Jim McBride. I love that book. Anthony Morrow's book, A Constellation of Vital Phenomenon. You know, just any time I'm in front of people, I want to push books on them. And I've always felt that way. So owning a bookstore is pretty genius because I can walk into the store and walk up to any stranger and say, have you read this book? Did you read Where'd You Go, Bernadette? You're going to love this book. and people buy it and read it and come back and say, I love that book. I want another one. Now what should I read next?
You write in that piece, you may have heard the news that the independent bookstore is dead, that books are dead, that maybe even reading is dead, to which I say, pull up a chair, friend. I have a story to tell. Why do you think we got that rap that books were in some way dying?
I think it was a slow news day. And I think that they came out with e-readers and a lot of people switched over to the e-reader, to which I say, great. What I care about is that people read. I don't care what device they read on. But if 40% of new books are being sold on e-readers, then the media says, well, you know, obviously books are dead. And in 2 years, nobody will have a paper book and there won't be such a thing as a paper book. And that's ridiculous. You know, it's kind of like women are allowed to wear pants. So let's just throw out all the dresses and skirts because obviously we're moving forward and they're never going to wear a dress again. It's just a matter of choice. We have more choices now. And I think that that's a positive thing. And it's true, we may not ever need a 30,000 square foot bookstore again, but we are always going to need a 3,000 square foot bookstore because the things that bookstores provide for communities are things that you're just never going to get online.
And, I mean, you tell a great story in the book about being on the Colbert Report, and Stephen Colbert holds up the book and says you can get it on Amazon, and then suddenly, without thinking, you say, no, get it at
ParnassusBooks.net. And I'll sign it for you.
And a lot of people did.
And we had been open for, I don't know, like a couple of months. We did not have the whole mail order thing down at all. We were scrambling. And so many orders came in and we were filling them out of my house because there wasn't room to do it in the bookstore. And I can remember staying up there, people from the bookstore coming over and working, my mother, friends, everybody's stuffing envelopes. I'm madly signing books. And I kept taking the orders off the computer and I was handwriting out all the labels and we were making the packages. I mean, it was truly hysterical, the extent to which we didn't know what we were doing. But I couldn't figure out why it was that no matter how many names I took off the list on the website for book orders, I couldn't decrease the number. And I didn't know if I wasn't deleting them after I had written them down. What was I doing wrong? And at some point, like 2 days later, I was just panic stricken. I am not techno savvy. It was just that orders kept coming in. It was that no matter how many I took off, there was just this never-ending tide coming in. And, you know, now, fortunately, we know how to deal with these things. The most important thing, I think, and this is so basic, it's real estate. It really is about the size of the store and the rent. And, you know, is that sustainable in this economy? My main message, though, is if you want to use Amazon, use Amazon. That's fine. If you like the things that a bookstore gives you, which is a place to go with your family after dinner, a place to take your kids to hear story hour, a place to go and meet famous authors who come in to give readings, a place to meet other readers and get book recommendations, if you want to use what the store offers, then you need to support your local bookstore or your local plant shop or your local liquor store or your local hardware store. If you're getting something from a business in your community and you want that business to stay, this isn't rocket science, then you have to go out and spend your money there and make sure that it remains a healthy and viable business. What is not okay ever is to go to your local gardening store and spend an hour saying what plants grow best in shade, what plants grow best in sun, what fertilizer should I use, and then go over to Home Depot and buy them for a third less. In the same way, you are not allowed to come into my bookstore and talk to the people and say, you know, what do you recommend? What do you like? What should I get? Pick up the books, read the flap copy, mill around, go to story hour, and then go home and buy that book on Amazon for $5 less. That's not good manners.
Again, the name of the new book is This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. It is published by Harper. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.